Hello, everyone, and welcome to Heavy Pod is Heavy Cast episode. I don't know. Who cares? Hi.
Lemon Party Edition.
Where did that come from, dude? That's weird. Why would you?
Yeah. We didn't talk about it before we started recording.
Yeah. Weird. Yes. If you don't know what a lemon party
is. What do we have to do to get you to stop listening? No, tell us. What do we have to do? Do we have to, like, do the Navy SEAL copy pasta just for every episode?
I mean, if that's what it takes, let me pull it up.
I have a better idea.
What?
Let's get canceled.
Ooh.
Let's interview John Schaefer for my stuff.
But I feel like that's only going to make us more popular. It's the metal scene.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It's just we're just going to change our current demographic for, like, Nazis.
What the fuck did they fucking say about me, you little bitch? I'll have you know, I graduated top of my class.
I immediately regret this.
I'm trained in guerrilla warfare, you know.
Oh my god.
Anyway, hello. It's been like 3 years since we did one of these, so let's go ahead and do it.
Let's do it. To it.
What?
I don't know, man.
Yeah, that one. Yes. So all right. So here's the deal. There's no deal. Sorry. Let's talk about something.
Here's the deal. The planet is on fire. I don't know if you knew that, but it kind of is. Like, right now, not literally, but soon.
I mean, I'm sure there's a fire somewhere.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, like, on a global scale, right? But soon, I don't know, in, like, 4 months, maybe, Noyan's house will be on fire?
Oh, yeah, I'm in the Bay Area, and, you know, we're approaching fire season.
And there's a drought right now.
No, it's been raining a lot lately, actually.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I heard there was a drought. Anyway, so there's a band who's been telling us that the Earth is on fire for a long time now, and they're called Gojira.
Yes.
They should do like a Gojira versus King Kong thing now that the movie is out. Anyway.
Is that a King Kong themed metal band?
Yeah, so
not blues.
I think it's fair to say that Noyan and I have been kind of lukewarm about Gojira's output in the last few years.
Like,
by lukewarm, I mean we hate it.
Yeah, by a few years, we mean like decade plus.
Yeah, exactly. But I think there's no doubting that these guys, you know, are committed to their message and have always been committed to their message. You know, they've worked with a Sea Shepherd and other organizations to really, you know, use their money and fame to promote the things that they preach. And I've always admired that about them, even when the music wasn't up to par. I did always feel, you know, they're not sellouts. They are committed to their ideals. So now they launched a new track called Amazonia.
Yep.
And the track is whatever.
Very medium.
You know, it
feels like, so the thing about the track is that it really feels like a Soulfly track. Everyone has the Berimbau that is in a lot of Soulfly tracks. I feel like not getting Max Cavalera on this song is just a huge missed opportunity.
Yeah, it's a miss, for sure. Especially when they have ties, like they've worked before.
Yeah, Joe was in Cavalera Conspiracy playing bass on the first album.
Yeah, exactly. So I feel like, just pick up the phone, you know? No, I'm sure Max is also a very busy guy, so I don't know if there was, like, conflicts there. But forget the track. The track is, like, whatever. They also launched an operation, or as Joe calls it in the video, a movement. Let's call it a fundraiser, because that's what it is. Raising money for the struggles of indigenous people in the Amazon. So let's get like the technicals out of the way. You basically donate how much you can, however much you can, and you get entered to either bid for exclusive items or you enter a raffle specifically to win a guitar that Joe has hand carved a skull on, like a cool skull, not a lame, like, you know, high school skull. It also has like fortitude pickups on them, and it's like, you know, this super cool guitar. And you can also bid on stuff that's not Gojira. I think some other bands are also pitching in here, like signed snails and stuff like that, and Slayer motorcycle helmet and all sorts of like collector item. And then those proceeds go towards building specifically healing huts for indigenous people, which is where they tend to the wounded and the sick, but also give birth on their own, like, you know, tribal lands, and also in general for the struggle. They're working with some of like the biggest names in indigenous rights in Brazil. So, and this is,
oh, by the
one
way,
of the things that I,
there's a Mexica Villar signed guitar among one of the items.
Got it. So it's probably like a scheduling thing, right?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, so that's the technical stuff aside. And you know, the raffle is cool, but also the struggle is just and moral and right and a good cause, you know, beyond the raffle. And we'll get to that in a sec. What I loved about this is that they actually brought in, you know, some really like experts on indigenous struggles and indigenous people themselves and people who lead their movements within Brazil. Like Sonia Guajajara, sorry, is like one of the biggest indigenous rights activists on the planet. Like I know of her before this video. She leads a coalition of 300 groups that are fighting in Brazil and other names among them. So it was really very awesome to see Joe, you know, speaking to them and understanding from them what they need. And it's not just, you know, the Bill Gates Foundation, right? It's not like Westerners coming in and doing the things that they think is correct. It's actually going towards activists on the ground.
Cop to it that, you know, when they put out the music video, I was, you know, kind of skeptical about Gojira's El Haidem, but this is very much legit.
Yeah, for sure. 100%. And so that's that stuff. And first of all, we're donating as a blog. We've donated $100, which is the maximum amount. And if we win the guitar, then we'll figure out what to do with it. We'll probably like do another. We probably won't win it, right? Because it's like the odds are slim. But if we do, we won't keep the guitar. We'll like do another fundraiser or something and we'll figure it out. But we donated $100. And if you can spare it, I really urge you to donate as well. And it's really hard to oversell this, but like the struggle for indigenous people's rights to the Amazon beyond how just and moral and correct it is literally one of the most important struggles on the planet right now. Yep. Like
in terms of climate change, the Amazon being burnt down is kind of a deal.
Yeah. I don't know if you've noticed this, but Bolsonaro is a fucking ethno-fascist psychopath. And if there is no scenario where the Amazon forest burns down and we also manage to mitigate climate change, like that doesn't work. And the people who know how to stop that from happening and how to fix the damage that we've done are the indigenous people who have been tending to those forests for thousands of years, like literally. And they have the skills and they have the capability and they have the political organizations to do what needs to be done. So this is like one of the most important struggles out there. And it's really fucking awesome that Gojira are doing this. And you should consider donating if you can.
Yep.
That's it.
Yes. I don't know if the song was good. No.
What's the segue? That's my question.
Right. So the segue here is that I am stalling, but let's go to something else that is bittersweet.
April Fools, there's no segue.
No, let's go to something else that's bittersweet.
Okay.
So this really is bittersweet. More bitter than sweet, honestly, but hey. As we know, Children of Bodom frontman Alexi Laiho passed away a few weeks back. I believe it was revealed that, you know, it was basically due to his lifelong battle with alcoholism. And, you know, that, that sucked. You know, he's a legend, right? He's insanely influential. Like, basically the entire metal scene came out and said, you know, I was influenced by him. His music was, you know, what got me here. I mean, same for me as well, right? So I didn't know this was happening, but they just put out a new song and video by him. Turns out that after kind of Bodom fell out, I didn't know that they fell out, but apparently they did. And he put together in 2020 a new band called Bodom After Midnight with the other guitar player that he had in Bodom at the time. And this, basically, they put out a single. Apparently, they recorded an EP of three tracks, Paint the Sky with Blood, and they released the title track from this, and it's great. Like, it's, you know, the best Bodom, air quotes, has sounded in a while. And apparently it was, you know, recorded before his passing, and they even shot the music video. And it will also have, basically, it's going to be two songs on a Dissection cover. And of course, the band said that they're not going to continue without Alexei, but yeah, it's really bittersweet to see this. It's great. You know, it's kind of what could have been. And that's all there is to it.
Yeah, I think this is a good opportunity as well to, you know, think about the complicated legacies of people like Alexei.
Yep.
I think also in recent times, he was a problematic person, right? He had a lot of fallings out and a lot of beef with a lot of people inside Bodom as well, by the way.
Yes.
A lot of business related conflicts.
Revolving door of members near the.
Yeah, exactly. And even going back to his early days, he spent 2 years in Impaled Nazarene.
Yeah.
Which are like, they had lyrics, you know, about Nazism and like flagrant homophobia and stuff like that. And of course, he was super young back then, but I think he never fully reconciled with that legacy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the metal scene also never fully reconciled with that legacy.
Yeah.
And it was interesting to see, you know, the discourse when he passed was, first of all, it was terrible, you know, the internet and how it handles these things. But then once the dust settled and a lot of people started talking about it, you know, he was a complicated person, right?
Yep.
And you can bet that if he lost the battle to alcoholism, that also played a big part in, you know, who he was and how he comported himself in the world. And yeah, I think it's, you know, way back when in season one of Heavy Pot is Heavy Cast, we talked a lot about how this stuff is going to happen more and more, right? As the stars of metal become old.
Yep.
Right? Metal is a young genre, but it's becoming older and older. And I think it's interesting to see how it's just like the mainstream, right? It's just like when David Bowie died, for example, and all the things from his past were dredged up. I'm not saying that's bad.
Yeah.
But I'm also saying that there's like
it's complicated.
An eagerness. It's complicated, yeah. And there's also like an eagerness to woke scold and, you know, lash out at people for not knowing about these things. And I think maybe Alexei is an opportunity, you know, to have a more intelligent and understanding conversation about people who were icons, you know? Like, when I heard the early Follow the Leader and stuff like that, it was part of my childhood, you know? And I had no idea who Impaled Nazarene were. Yeah. Like, I couldn't even Google it, right? It didn't even show up in the related artists, like, on whatever fucking site I was using.
Even if I knew who they were, like, I didn't, like, I loosely knew that Impaled Nazarene was a band, but I didn't know their lyrics. I didn't look into it. And, like, metal lyrics are just, like, you know, like, I don't look,
unintelligible.
Yeah. I don't look into lyrics. Eh.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's complicated, and I think we should expect, you know, more of these legacies to be as complicated, right?
Yep. Yeah, and you know, there is no good way to handle it. Right? There is no, you know, the government-sanctioned way to handle these things.
Yeah, let's ask the commissars, and they'll tell us what to think about this.
Anyway, yeah, it sucks, but the music is good, and, you know, complicated legacy, so it's understandable that that's, you know, you don't vibe with that, and that's cool. And it's understandable you vibe with that. That's cool as well. Yeah, it's just bittersweet. More bitter than sweet.
Yeah. Yeah.
But here's something that's melodic and sweet. I've been meaning to talk about this thing for fucking months now. We just never had the opportunity to, like, sit down and have, like, a proper conversation. which is the new Stortrain album. I don't know how the fuck you pronounce this.
Is that how you pronounce it? I have no fucking idea.
Yeah, I pronounce it as Stortrain, but like, who the fuck knows? They're Swiss.
Yeah.
So, you know.
I mean, I think we should delay on that for a second. I think like Switzerland has a really underrated metal scene.
Oh yeah,
And post-rock and post-metal as well. So you have Shamash, who we had on the cast ages ago.
Yep,
and that was makes a fun great. That was a fun one for sure. Yeah, we have these guys now. I'm not gonna say their name. I'm just gonna say these guys. There's a lot of really good post-metal, like Hubris and other bands of that sort. So really cool scene over there.
Apparently it's Stortrain with like a in the first O.
Okay.
But anyway, it means downpour, apparently.
Downpour. Cool. Yes. Awesome. So they released Impermanence.
Yes.
And it's fucking awesome.
Yeah, it's my album of the year so far. It's like their
Yeah, I can see that.
It's like their fifth album, apparently. I never knew of this band before. They're on Artisan Era now. So it's like, if you take Obscura's Cosmogenesis album, add to it some like Gorod style, you know, groovy, you know, irreverence, add to it Melodeath, like the, you know, mid-era In Flames style elements, add to it black metal. It's basically this, and it's super, super sweet. It's like very grandiose, very cheesy at times. Very melodic and like very, very well produced, very well recorded. It's fantastic. And if any of those things appeal to you, I would highly urge you to check this album out. It's been like my go-to ever since before it came out. I've just been like, you know, if I want to listen to something but I don't know what I listen to, which happens a lot, I just, you know, pull up Cosmos Eater from this album and it's great.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think for me, what gets across the vibe is that they have a Paolo Girardi cover art. You know, that weird brown cosmic style that he has. Lots of bands have used him in the last few years, like Lion's Daughter, among others. And he tends to like attract a certain type of band. And these guys kind of sound like that. But I think they're more technical than a lot of bands in this like space.
Yeah.
And it's interestingly technical, right? It's not like you won't find the tropes that you're expecting.
Yeah, they're an Artisan Era, so Artisan Era kind of, you know,
yeah, exactly,
has this vibe of like bands like Inferi and whatnot, but it's not like that.
Yeah, the tone is like meatier, right? Mm-hmm. It's less thin and very, you know, very tappy and shreddy. Here, because of the black metal stuff, there's this really cool thickness and abrasiveness to it that's added.
Yep.
Which is awesome. Yeah, this album is really good. It's been fitting very well with my design abstract listening and my Beast of Nod listening.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of like it communicates with those albums in certain ways, but then it takes it in a completely different direction.
Yep, it's like I feel like it's because they're not primarily a tech band, but they're as techy as a tech band. So I think that's how it comes off.
Yeah, for sure. I totally agree.
Speaking of Beast of Nod, I guess.
Yeah, I was setting you up for that one.
Yeah, so, you know, we actually tried to record an episode interviewing Beast of Nod. Their new album, Multiversal, came out this week. It was fantastic. Unfortunately, due to technical issues, you know, we lost the recording of that, which is really sucks because it was a cool interview. But I will say Beast of Nod is really cool, progressive death metal, for lack of a better term, but I think that doesn't do them justice. They have this whole multiverse concept with like original artwork, lore. If you go to their website, they have this encyclopedia of lore, and there is the story that they're telling throughout the albums that is just full of cool stuff. I would say definitely go check out Multiversal if you're into like progressive music. It's a very original sound, very cool guys.
Yeah, I think like for me, I wanted to say it during the interview and I didn't get the chance. It's like, you know how you sat down with your friends in high school and you built like your own shared universe and maybe you ran like a D&D campaign and you always said you would do something big with it and then you never did because you're kind of lazy and you moved on with your life. These guys didn't.
Yep.
Like these guys in a good way. Like they took their vision and they said, okay, we're going to be serious about this. Like, we're going to teach ourselves all the skills that we need, like promotion and design and character design and all that shit, and obviously the musical skills, to bring this universe to life. And it's cheesy and over the top, but in a really good way. And the album itself just rules. You know, the music is first and foremost, and it's clear that it's also first and foremost for them. So it's not like a universe and then the music tacked on. So go check out Multiversal and consider supporting them. Like they said in the interview, they're an independent band. So whatever you put in is what they can then put out in, as far as live shows when those come back and more lore and more merch.
They're in the Bay Area, as I am. And the Bay Area is resuming live shows April 15th.
Oh, nice. In fact, congrats.
The pandemic's over.
Yeah, sure. It's not like you're not all vaccinated or anything.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. But hey, if they do a live show, you know, and I'm vaccinated, I'll go.
Maybe they'll ban you now that we lost the audio.
Ah. True. But that sure that also gives that. Me an opportunity to do a live interview.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
While they're playing, I'll just be asking them questions in the middle of the show. And then just like direct the microphone to the stage.
Speaking of stopping Noyan from talking, speaking of interesting and unique death metal, there's a new
Born of Osiris.
Illustrium album announced, and there's a new track called This Hollow Ache. These guys are on Unique Leader now. Mm-hmm. And I think we were kind of like prophetic, right? Like 6 months ago, we were like, hey, Unique Leader is like getting better.
Yes.
And signing like more diverse bands. And the roster is actually pretty impressive. And then they go and sign one of our favorite bands right now, like death metal bands. At least for me, I think you agree though.
They're really good.
They're really super good. And they released an EP last year, which we really loved for its, you know, how cohesive it was and condensed. And it kind of like built on the promise of the previous album, Eternal to Me, Eternal to Eden. and this new album is called A Monument to Silence.
Yep.
And the new track fucking rules.
Would you say it slaps?
It does slap. I would say it fucks. I would say it, I don't have another one. It brings
shivers
the beat
me
back. Shivers me timbers. It got me pregnant, as the gent kids say. Are there still gent kids? I'm sure there are.
Yeah, it kind of transitioned into this like Instagram thing.
Oh god. Not TikTok?
Well, now it's transitioning to TikTok, but yes.
Yeah. Back to This Hollow Ache, which is how TikTok makes me feel. this track is really good. And I'm really happy to see that they're kind of like staying to the style on the EP, right? It's more direct and aggressive, but still very technical. But it doesn't have some of that filler that Tunnel to Eden had. Although I guess we'll have to wait for the album, right, to see how everything falls into place. But I'm really hyped by this new track, and I can't wait for it to be out.
I can, but it's okay. It's good. No, it's okay. Okay, I don't know why I said that.
No, but
it's really
now
good.
You understand why I need such long breaks in between episodes. That's why we need all those like special episodes so we don't have to do this every fucking week.
No, it's since we haven't done this in a while. You know, it's kind of built up, right? I have to like.
Yeah, you gotta get your troll out. Oh, yeah, no, I get it.
No, I think this track is great. I think Illustrium is like weirdly they just keep getting better and better, and I'm.
Yeah.
Excited to see how this translates to a full album, because I think the one thing that we said about the EP was that before that they had an album and it kind of got a little bit kind of like a meat grinder, just kind of too much of the same sound. But the EP, you know, the reason the EP worked was that it's shorter, so it's like, you know, it doesn't overstay its welcome. It'll be interesting to see if they've developed that area of their sound so that it can still be compelling throughout the course of a full-length album.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah.
Speaking of Instagram guitarists, there's a new Born of Osiris song, White Nile. So,
yeah.
And by the way, they have a new guitar player. So actually, they had a new bass player because the previous guy was an asshole, so they kicked him out. And then they got a new guy. But they just moved him to being a guitar player instead, and they just don't really have a bass player right now. Which, you know, a lot of these bands kind of do these days. The new track is called White Nile. They've released it as a single so far. Like, there's no album announcement or whatever yet, but, you know, who knows? Or maybe we'll get one.
Yeah.
It's perfectly serviceable, but not much beyond that, I would say. You know, if you've been following the trajectory of their, like, last two albums, it's basically around there. Though I will say the production is, I think, much better. Like, this is, I think they did, like, a kind of reorienting of their sound when they did the Eternal Rain re-recording, mm-hmm. and they've kind of stayed consistent with that since then, which is nice. But yeah, it's okay. The one thing that is kind of different about this song is that with the new guy, they have like a more Polyphia style solo in the song, and that's something that they previously, you know, didn't really have in their sound. But that's what all the cool kids are doing these days, and it's okay. Like, it's fine. It's a perfectly fine track.
So let me do the Eden thing and extrapolate wildly from this on a bigger trend.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm going to call it Which Way Sumerian Core. Which path will you choose? So you either go the unprocessed route and you say, not only is Sumerian Core dead, right?
Mm-hmm.
And technical, like, shreddy YouTube, whatever style guitar playing is gone. But also, it's boring to us, so we need to figure out what we want to do with our sound. And then you go on this path where you kind of rebuild your aesthetic, kind of like how Unprocessed did, right?
Mm-hmm.
Rebuild your aesthetic, rebuild your sound, do cool stuff with it. You don't have to reject everything, like the Polyphia guest spot on Unprocessed's previous single. And also, the vibe is still there, right? They still have the headless guitars and the Instagram-worthy outfits and all that shit.
Oh, yeah, dude, that was one thing I was going to say. Lee, their, like, existing guitar player, that look just does not work for him at all. He looks so awkward.
Yeah, I agree. Or you do serviceable Born of Osiris like tracks, right? Like, you just you mess with things, you put in new stuff,
mm-hmm.
but you don't really change the formula.
Yeah,
because I think we can all agree, like we just said on the previous topic as a joke, but I think it's pertinent. Like, this is a 2014 joke. Gent is dead. Deep heavy blog. Lol. But I think, oh god, don't do that. But I think nowadays it's like unironically true.
Yeah.
Like, Gent is gone.
Yeah, it's like it ate its own ass.
Yeah, exactly. Gent Ouroboros, yeah. So what are these bands going to fucking do? Like, what do you do when the genre that catapulted you into popularity, and that's Sumerian Records in a nutshell, right?
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to do? And I think Sumerian, in the last 2 or 3 years, have been doing a really bad job at, like, finding a new niche. So, and I'll tell you why.
They've had all these, like, alt-pop bands going on.
Yeah. So it's like they think they can just move on to whatever the Gent kids moved on to.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They think they can just say, oh, well, now we're, like, an alt-rock, kind of pop-punk kind of, you know, bands. But it doesn't work that way. So I'll tell you how I know it doesn't work, because it's like a clapometer. It's not very accurate, but 2 or 3 years ago, I would hear the name Sumerian Records every, like, month or two.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Someone would email me about it or post one of their bands. But in the last 2 years, I've, like, heard about Sumerian Core twice. Right? Like, once or twice. And not to, like, toot my own horn or, you know, be pretentious or whatever, but Heavy Blog used to represent the core of Sumerian Records listenership. Like, I don't think it's exaggerated to say that in the heyday, we would cover every single Sumerian band.
Yep.
Like, when it was exploding, right? So if we don't hear about it anymore, and the people who read the blog don't hear about it anymore, and I'm not getting emailed about it by PR, then what the fuck are they doing? Like, where is the label? It's so weird.
Yeah, they've tried to pivot to a new audience, but it comes off as really, like, okay, boomer.
Yeah, it's inauthentic. And I'm not even talking about all the movies that Ash tried to make or whatever. Oh, yeah. I get it. He has his passion. But like, I'm looking at the header on YouTube now.
Mm-hmm.
Who are what? First of all, what is in common to these acts? Like, they have the Smashing Pumpkins, which is like, and then Mag Myers, which I think does like kind of like an electropop kind of thing.
Yeah.
Bad Omens, Lilith Zahr, like
Bad Omens.
What's happening?
So meh. They're like,
yeah.
Yeah. You know what they sound like?
Yeah, yeah, I do. I do. Okay. I do.
Yeah.
They have Veil of Maya, but like they're not good anymore.
Yeah.
And there's no like, yeah, there's no identity.
I think the problem was that that whole movement of like gent. So I think there was this kind of train of movements ever since the kind of Web 2.0 became like a thing and music was growing along with it. And the American music scene, you had like, you know, first it started with stuff that is kind of screamo-like or whatever. And then you had metalcore, and then you had deathcore, and then you had djent. And it's just like all of these genres have been kind of popular in like a de facto way. Like they were, their popularity was kind of organic, but then, you know, it would be like everybody would kind of oversubscribe to these genres. And then the genre yeah. would just like dive. And like the whole thing with these genres, they're like relatively easy to make, relatively easy to get into. And there was this like kind of ongoing momentum. But I think as the music scene changed, with like streaming services and all that stuff, I think the strain of genres finally was unable to keep up with the change in like how music is listened to with like both social media and streaming services. And this whole train kind of fell apart. And there, you've seen a lot of bands that have kind of just hopped genres along as these things changed. You know, Bring Me the Horizon is like the key example. And I think they're like one of the only ones who have been successfully navigating this whole thing. I think that's because they've been investing in the next thing before it became the next thing. Like they, while everybody else was still in the realm of like djent and deathcore, they already moved down to like alt pop rock. And then, you know, they were always kind of ahead of the curve and everybody else was trying to play catch up with them. But like Sumerian clearly like was able to harness a particular moment in this movement. But then they have demonstrated that they don't really have the pulse. They just kind of got lucky by having the being in the right place at the right time. But they were not like able to capitalize
in
on
tune.
That. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. It's interesting. It's again another factor and things we might start seeing more and more as metal ages.
Yep.
Right? And people think, you know, in 2013 or 14, people were like, we're already past the heyday of djent. But now we're really past the heyday. Like now it's a memory. It's like history at this point.
Yeah.
And now you can start seeing, you know, what the ramifications of that are and which bands have been able to reinvent themselves, hint very few of them. And also the labels and everyone that kind of like grew up around that scene, grew up in this, not in the age sense, right? Like in the financial and popularity sense. What, how are they adapting or not adapting? And what are the tactics that they're employing to try and stay relevant?
And I think the one key question is in the age of social media, where the bands have their primary relationship with the audience through like Instagram and TikTok and whatnot, what purpose does the label really serve?
Yeah. And I feel like especially in these genres or like where these genres are going, there's a lot of, first of all, it's a lot of young people, right, that are into bands like Unprocessed and stuff like that. And even Unprocessed are like just a metal band's attempt to kind of, I'm not saying that cynically, it's just what they're doing, right? Like to tap into that vibe. There are much bigger artists inside that space, right? Mm-hmm. That communicate directly with younger people, right? Directly through apps like TikTok.
Mm-hmm.
And so I totally agree with you. You know, even if we keep seeing what am I trying to say here? The more that we keep seeing stuff like EPs and albums, and between you and me, those are like more like internet metal nerd stuff.
Yeah.
Right? Like, most people don't really care about, look at, Lil Nas and his release that's causing Puritans to like have their heads fucking explode. He's not releasing an album, but he's platinum.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because the album format is no longer necessarily relevant. And a lot of what labels did was help you collect the album, right?
And distribute.
Distribute, master it, get the artwork, get it out there, do the, like the copy editing and the paging and all that stuff. But that shit is not as important as it is. Like, even going back to metal, look at Beast of Nod.
Yeah.
Like, they do all that stuff that they do. They're very successful. And they don't have a label because they don't need one.
Yeah. And like, as you know, once you're, you know, nowadays, it's really easy to just put your music into a streaming service. So like,
yeah.
What is the barrier that bands are solving for, sorry, labels are solving for bands now? Like, there isn't really as much value added anymore.
Yeah, and I think the interesting side effect is like it seeps backwards and you're asking, wait, what value did labels have at all? Like, also in the past.
I mean, handling the physical distribution, handling the PR and whatnot, like, but now it's like, you know, you don't necessarily need PR. You just go like build a social media following. And sure, like labels can help you do that, right? Like they are. In good labels, you would have people who are professionals who, with like social media professionals now. But it's just like a new skill set, right? That's not basically the way that Sumerian was able to be successful through things like, you know, having the right connections, having the right distribution or whatever. Those things are not as relevant anymore.
Yeah, I totally agree. And if we talk about the positive for a second, I do think that labels in the format that we usually shout out on the podcast, like Unique Leader and like Willow Tip, for example, and iVoidHanger, mm-hmm. they help when you're a small band trying to cut through the noise.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if someone like, oh, what's the example that I want to give here? Like Illustrium or Countless Skies, mm-hmm. right? If they just put their album out there on Spotify, I probably never would have listened to it.
Yeah.
But because it was released on Willow Tip, anything that gets released under Willow Tip, not just for me, but like for a few, I'd say thousands of people across the planet, it's like, oh, I need to listen to this.
Yeah.
Right?
At that point, like the smaller the scene is, the more relevant the label is. Because then it's like a,
yeah,
it becomes a matter of like,
curation.
Yeah. Exclusion. Right. Then it's like, there's some, like you go there because you know that there's a vibe to this thing. And that's what you go for, as opposed to something like Sumerian, where it's like,
exactly,
why am I here? Like, what are we doing?
Why is there like my album and then a TV show that you're trying to push? Yeah. Like, what the fuck is the identity here? Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's and we haven't seen nothing yet, right? Like, it's gonna keep changing, and that's one of the difficulties of being a content creator, not just in a band, by the way, but also in other avenues, and trying to stay not just relevant, but also plugged into the people who consume your content.
Yep.
Which is why we never take this podcast seriously.
Yep.
Because it's all just screams in the ether anyway.
Speaking of being on streaming services, the Luna's Call album is now on streaming services. That came out last year.
Just now?
Yeah.
Yeah, what the fuck?
Yeah, I don't know. It's Void by Luna's Call. It's progressed, like it's great. Like I had it I listened to it when it came out, but I bought it on Bandcamp, but then I forgot it to sync to my like Apple Music, and then it just kind of fell through. But now that I listened to it again, it's great. It's like, imagine like Opeth, but they actually made heavy music, and that's like a weird angle that nobody could have thought of, but it's like that, but it's really cool.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's really underrated. I had some problems with the production, if I recall correctly. Like, some of it wasn't super clear, but I haven't listened to it in like maybe over a year because we got the promo before it released, right? So I need to go back and listen to it. I did enjoy what I liked, but I found myself being kind of fatigued by some of the production.
I enjoyed it overall.
No, it's a good album. I just need to like put it back in my rotation.
It's like, you know, what if Opeth didn't stop existing after Watershed?
Yeah, it's a real shame they broke up after that album.
And then we got the Michael Åkerfeldt
side project.
Bonanza.
Storm Corrosion 2.0.
Oh my god. Anyway, cool, whatever. Yeah, go listen to Lunascal Void now on streaming services. Because...
Hell yeah.
But, like, buy the album if you want to support the band as well. Whatever.
As always.
Alright, cool. Let's move on to cool people stuff. There's a bunch of stuff that I want to talk about. Speaking of weird Swiss shit... so there's this new game called Mundown. It's a Swiss horror game, and it's in entirely a Swiss language. I didn't know this language like even existed. It's made by a Swiss developer, and it's sponsored by, like, you know, the Swiss community of arts or whatever, right?
Yeah.
The language called is Romansh, which is also called something like commoner Latin or something like that. So, like, it's a really interesting language. It sounds very Latin. But anyway, the game is a first-person horror adventure game. And I know that there's a dime a dozen of those out there, but this is one of the good ones. So the sell of the game is that it's entirely pencil-drawn, but 3D. So it's, like, very interesting art style if you look it up. Like, you'll immediately know what I'm saying. And the things they do with that art style is pretty cool, because they, like, they kind of distort it when things get weird, and that kind of gives, like, a really interesting aesthetic. And the sound design in the game is fantastic as well. The setup for the game is that you grow up in this, like, small village in the Alps, and then you get this letter saying, hey, your grandfather died, his barn burned down. But no worries, you know, we'll take care of it. Everything is fine. Nothing weird going on. Please don't come here. No need to worry about anything. But then your character goes like, you know, this sounds like hella sus, so I'll go check it out. And of course, like, weird shit starts happening as you go there. It's very, like, folk horror-y, right? So if you like movies like The Witch, Midsommar, Wicker Man, it has that kind of vibe. The gameplay is basically... There's a little bit of combat, but, like, your character is not really good at combat, so you want to kind of, like... So I think that with these type of games, striking the balance of, like, amount of combat versus frustration of combat is pretty challenging. And I think this game has a really good balance of, like, there's not a lot of combat, and when it happens, there's not a lot of, like... You're not very good at it, but it's not terrible enough that you feel frustrated. So it's good. And basically it's like a, not an open world, but like you have these like large areas where you need to go around and like find, you know, items. It's like an adventure game, right? You know, you find the thing that lets you do the thing and then whatever. But the atmosphere is really cool and the story is cool. Story is kind of predictable, but it's more about kind of the delivery.
The vibe.
Yeah. And I thought it was like really good. Like I played so many of these games that they all kind of blur together, but this one, you know, actually was, I was compelled by this one. It was good. So I recommend, if you're into that kind of stuff, check it out.
Yeah, and I think the natural segue here is into Genesis Noir.
Yeah, that game, I wish it was better.
Yeah, same. So, well, first of all, you know, the first time I saw the trailer for this, I was like, oh, someone made a game for me, specifically. Mm-hmm. Like... They went
I was
going to
recommend this
to you,
but then I was like, it's kind of clunky, so I didn't. But yeah, it's very our thing.
Yeah, it's like magic realism, but film noir, lots of jazz. The sound design is also really fucking good.
Lots
like,
of
entire
like,
soundtrack.
Quantum time travel weird bullshit.
Yeah, so the setting, the premise, which is the best part about it, by the way. I just read this book. They just should write it as a book. Is... A jealous god shoots another god, and the bullet is the Big Bang, which starts creation. And then you go into the Big Bang, and you solve like a series of puzzles to undo creation, basically go back to your loved one. Mm-hmm. And there are a few problems.
It's really janky.
First of all, it's janky, like the control of a lot of the objects that you're supposed to manipulate. A lot of the puzzles are like physical, yeah, right? Like you spin things, you put them together and so on. And a lot of the controls are really bad. But also, like, game design wise, there aren't, you can't go back. Mm-hmm. There's no load mechanism. So if you miss something, you just miss it. And the game is not good at telling you, if you click this, you'll move on to the next screen.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to explore, but you're literally like worried about clicking on things because that might take you to the next screen.
Yeah.
Right? So I was very frustrated with that in the beginning. Like, I wanted to explore, so I just clicked this thing. Oh, okay, loading screen time. I'm in the next scene. I can't go back. And I missed on a bunch of lore and stuff like that. There's also jank around the graphics.
Right.
A lot of people have reported, like, lag, objects disappearing.
There's also jank with the sound. Like, if you have multiple sound devices, it's just, like, it randomly picks a sound device and, like, it kept like picking up my VR headset as the primary sound device, and like I couldn't hear anything in the game.
Yeah, and to be fair, it's a small studio,
sure. Yeah,
right. And they've already released some sort of patch. I haven't looked at the release notes yet. Hopefully, they'll fix some of this. Some of this is unfixable, right? Like, I don't think they're gonna fix the controls, mm-hmm, right? But hopefully they can release some sort of update to the graphics engine maybe or something like that. We'll fix some of the graphic jank. It is worth checking out, mm-hmm, I would say, but I'd wait for like a sale.
Yeah. It's actually on, Game Pass.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
it was from day one, by the way, which is interesting.
Yeah. So if you have Game Pass, it's on Game Pass PC as well. So if you have that on PC, like you can check it out. Game Pass as a whole is a mess in general, but like, I had it for something else, so this was there. So I was like, I checked it out, you know? Like, so it's like, yeah, cool.
Yeah, I recommend checking it out. Like, it's beautiful.
Yes.
And the idea is very interesting, and it's very unique. It's just not quite there.
Yep. Like, the surrealist, noir, quantum, whatever bullshit is just, like, a brilliant idea. I love it.
Yeah. It's done very well. It's written very well.
Yes. And the, like, art style is super cool. But it's just like, as a game, like, it's also like, it's not like that good as a game, honestly. If this was like a short animated film or something like that, I think it would be like 10 out of 10.
Yeah, I agree. 100%.
Okay. So here's the thing that I'm going to randomly drop. So I watched this horror movie called The Empty Man. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the trailer, it's looks like garbage along the lines of like Bye Bye Man or Slender Man, right? These like creepypasta horror movies, right?
Yeah.
But the trailer, like all of that stuff, is like 10% of the movie. The movie itself is like completely different. And I don't want to like really give away too much about it, but let me set it up a little bit. So it's directed by a first-time director. But this guy apparently is like David Fincher's protege, and he's basically filmed the making of documentaries for all of David Fincher's films. And like, he has the same aesthetic as David Fincher. So that's a plus. Mm-hmm. And the movie is more than anything an homage to a lot of Japanese horror classics, like, you know, The Grudge, The Ring, and Kiyoshi Kurosawa's like movies like Cure and whatnot. It's like really basically like a spiritual successor to something like The Grudge, but done in like an American horror context. So the thing with the movie is it's like super ambitious in terms of like the scope keeps changing. It opens with like a 20-30 minute sequence of some spooky shit happening in the Tibetan mountains. And then it cuts back to like, you know, America. And there's this guy, and there are these, like, kids who, you know, urban legend, local thing of, like, you know, oh, hey, if you go on a bridge and, like, blow into a bottle and, like, think about the empty man, he'll come get you in 3 days. That type of stuff, right?
Yeah.
And then he starts going deeper and deeper into this. But then it keeps getting weirder and weirder. Like, there's this cult, and there's a lot of, like, cosmic horror bullshit. It was really interesting. It was really good. Like, it's one of my favorite horror movies in, like, recent memory. It's a really interesting movie, and you know, it got a lot of poor reviews, and like not so it didn't get a lot of reviews first of all because like it looks like your average dog shit horror movie, but when you actually watch it, there's like a lot of nuance to it, and it's like super well made, and I thought it was like really, really good. And you know, I've made Cody and Tommy watch it, and they also like really liked it.
Interesting. So I'll put it on my list.
Yeah, it's like a really interesting movie, and I think there's some stuff in there that would specifically appeal to you as well.
Awesome. Sounds good. I'm sure Arnie will be happy to watch it.
There's like, especially like three scenes that are just like the creepiest shit. There's like three bad moments, like two bad jump scares and like one bad like CGI moment, but everything else is fantastic.
Sounds great.
While we're okay, I'll leave the Godzilla thing to the last. So let's get the other ones out of the way real quick.
Okay. Let's do.
Played the Monster Train DLC. Really good.
Is it out?
Oh yes, it is out.
I really like the faction when I played it on the beta they did.
Yeah.
I need to check.
It's really good. One thing that I feel though is like there's so many variables to track now. You know, there's I don't know if that was in the beta. I didn't play the beta, but like.
The shards.
Yeah, the shards and the infusion mechanic for the new faction, especially if you pair it with like one of the other factions that have their own like resource management, it can be a bit overwhelming. And I feel like the complexity built upon top of simplicity that was kind of the appeal of the original game is a little bit changed in terms of like now there's just a lot of complexity on top of it. I mean, I guess you have to kind of, you know, add more to the game somehow. And you can disable the DLC if you're not, you know, interested in that stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a classic problem, right? You have like feature bloat, basically, where you need to keep adding stuff to games to keep them engaging. Right?
Yeah.
But then you have too many things.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you're like super hardcore into Monster Train, I think they'll give more longevity to the game with kind of how all these different systems interact. Because, you know, the more independent systems you add, the more chances you have for those systems to commingle and, like, you know, lead to unique gameplay patterns. But I think sometimes, especially like as you go later into a game, it becomes a little bit of like, okay, you know, I need to plan out my turn. Like, I have to mind all three floors, and like, there's like five different resources I need to manage, and like, each of these enemies have like five different buffs and debuffs, and like, it just becomes a little bit like, oh man. Like, I'm tired. I don't want to do this, right? Like,
you need a break from the break.
Yeah, exactly. So that, but like, you know, that's fine. I think it adds longevity to the game, so it's not a big deal.
Speaking of feature bloat,
mm-hmm.
I've been playing the second Doom DLC. Mm-hmm. And I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm having fun, but I'm having fun because Doom Eternal is a great game. Yeah. But all of the additions made to the second DLC, I'm not a fan of. So I had some problems with the first DLC as well. And we spoke about it as well. And you had also some problems. Like the guys where you need to headshot. And the like snap sniping turrets.
Mm-hmm.
Like Doom is not about snap reflexes. It's not Counter-Strike. I don't play it to like flick my scope and hit stuff. And I feel like that really interrupts the flow of the combat, and there's more of them in this DLC, like also in really annoying places in battles. But also the hammer kind of feels like, oh man, I don't want to sound like a gatekeeping asshole, like it makes the game more accessible or whatever. I just feel like they could have put it on lower difficulties, because it makes a lot of the resource management really redundant. So that the way that it works is you charge it with two glory kills, and you can glory kill anything to charge it. So even if you glory kill like the simple one-shot guys, it charges it. It has a huge area of effect, especially after you upgrade it. And if you use it on its own, it's like a stun, like dazes enemies. But if you use it with the flame cannon and the ice bomb, it multiplies their effects.
Mm-hmm.
So like now the health and the armor that you get from it basically take you to full. If like you hit two or three big demons and you use the hammer, it gets you to full HP from like zero. So, and again, it's not hard to charge. So it just gives you a way out. Plus, they've made Marauders easier. So they do have their hounds. There was one of them that didn't have his hound. But the hammer increases the daze period when you hit them when they flash green. And then use the hammer. It like allows you to get like 5-6 arbalest shots in. And it makes them like so easy. I'm on the final boss. And the final boss is really cool. Like, of course, it's like a harder Marauder because they really like that mechanic. But the design is really cool. And he has this thing where when he hits you in melee, it recharges his health.
Mm.
So it becomes like even harder. And it's really cool. Oh, and one of the other... They just added like a bullet sponge. There's like an armored Baron. And he has armor. You got to shoot it with the energy cannon because that's the only one fast enough to get through the regen. Then the armor breaks and you can do damage to him, but the armor regenerates, right? Mm-hmm. So if you don't kill him fast enough, he gets the armor all over again. It's like artificially prolonging the fights, and it doesn't feel as tight. The story is, of course, ridiculous, and everything else is like Doom, and the game is still fun because Doom Eternal is one of the best FPSs ever made, I feel.
Yes.
And I know you agree. So it's hard to ruin it, but all the additions feel... I don't know, not as good as the base game for sure, and not even as good as the first DLC.
Yeah, I haven't checked out the DLC yet. I'm kind of, I don't know, waiting to be in the mood, because like you got to be in a mood to play Doom Eternal.
Yeah, it's like really you need to want to play. Like, yeah,
And like I just don't have the energy to do that in my gaming time lately. But yeah, I think. What it boils down to is that the base game is so perfect that there's not much else that you can add on top of it.
Yeah, I agree. And who? And you don't care about the storyline. Like,
yeah.
You don't need the storyline to be resolved or whatever. So, like,
yeah, it's okay. Whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, it's fine. I'm still having fun, but it's not what I wanted.
Yep. Okay, so the last thing is, I watched Godzilla vs. Kong, and I have thoughts with capital T.
Oh, God.
Okay, so these fucking movies, man. So I've always been a fan of the 2014 Godzilla movie. Now I feel like people are starting to turn back onto it, but I think that movie was always fantastic because it like really is very grounded. And it's by grounding it in like the human perspective, while the human perspective stuff is like kind of whatever, it was very really lets you appreciate how terrifying and big Godzilla is, right?
Wait, which one is the 2014 one? Is that
the Gareth Edwards one? With the like the base jumping scene, like they jump out of a plane.
Whatever. I don't think I watched that. It's not the one with the Hydra.
No, that's the second one.
Got it.
Yeah. So that one I think was really good. It's more like a horror movie, right? And I think that movie worked really well. It was also like really stylistic. And then you had King of the Monsters, which was ridiculous. That's the one with Hydra. The human stuff in it was pretty bad. But it was like
I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it. It was, I think it was overall good. It was like really majestic and epic, right? You had these like big orchestral moments, and like you really felt how huge and terrifying like Ghidorah and all the other monsters were.
Yeah, and Mothra was really good.
I thought that movie was good. The human stuff was pretty bad, but it was like not intrusively bad. Like it was just kind of like these scenes. If you just cut them out, the movie still works, and it would probably be better.
Yeah,
but like it didn't feel, you know, whatever. It was whatever. So Godzilla vs. Kong, this one is directed by Adam Wingard, who did The Guest, Your Next, and The New Blair Witch. So in this movie, the human stuff is aggressively terrible. It's really, really obnoxious. I hate the human stuff in this movie. Like you still have like Eleven from Stranger Things. And... they introduce this like podcaster guy that is like kind of Alex Jonesy, but like he's actually right, and like the conspiracy is true, and it's just kind of like
yikes.
No, because there is like the evil corporation that's, you know, been in these movies.
Yeah, I can extrapolate the storyline in my head.
So I'm just full spoilers into this movie because like the plot is so fucking stupid. So the plot of the movie is that this evil corporation, you know, at the post-credits scene of Kings of the Monsters, they like preserve one of Ghidorah's heads, right? Yeah. So they're using this to build Mechagodzilla. And the thing is that the tech billionaire character, evil bad guy in this movie, he basically thinks that, you know, he wants humans to be the apex predator, not Godzilla. So, you know, he's building Mechagodzilla as a kind of defense mechanism against Godzilla, right?
Yeah.
But when they're building this, so first of all, so this movie is full of so many, you know what, that's so fucking stupid, but sure. Like, you just don't care about the plot at all because it's just like so much stupid bullshit. So they open with saying, they don't tell you that it's like Mechagodzilla yet, right? It's like some artifact or whatever. It's agitating Godzilla, which causes them to attack human cities because Godzilla senses that Ghidorah's essence is still in the skull.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Right? And then they build Mechagodzilla and they're like, hey, this is only working at 40% power. So we need the like pure energy source.
The MacGuffin.
Now, the MacGuffin energy source that's actually in Hollow Earth. Sure. So, yeah, the Earth is hollow and there's another Earth inside that's like inverted and there's like this energy source in there. Sure. And then the thing is, though, this energy source, to get into Hollow Earth, you have to go through this portal, right? And the portal basically inverses gravity. So it's like you get whiplash. One of the characters is a scientist whose like brother died trying to do this because there's like too much energy going through the portal. Sure, right? to do this,
yeah,
they need King Kong because King Kong can withstand this transition, and he also knows where the MacGuffin is in Hollow Earth.
Yeah.
Sure.
Sure.
Yeah. and then they go with King Kong to Hollow Earth. and they're going on the way. They try to avoid somehow this company mobilizes all these battleships to carry King Kong to the Antarctic because that's where the entrance to Hollow Earth is. Sure. And their hope is that they will avoid Godzilla's like routes so that he won't attack them. Like they have no plan whatsoever. But of course Godzilla attacks them. And he like drags Kong down into the water to drown him. And just as he's drowning him, they drop some depth charges that like hurt Godzilla but somehow don't hurt Kong, even though they're like wrestling each other underwater. Sure. And then Kong goes back onto the ship. And they turn off the power from the ships so that Godzilla can't sense them. Sure. So they decide to airlift Kong to the Antarctic. And they're there. And then they enter the portal to Hollow Earth with like some magic spaceship thing that they've built that can withstand the portal transition. Sure. They enter Hollow Earth. And it's like, really, there's like this whole, you know, entire planet inside Earth. Just like inverted, right? Sure. Inside there, Kong finds a temple built by like his ancestors. Sure.
Precursors. Yeah.
And there he finds an axe. And this axe is, you know, a magical axe.
Oh my god. I'm already tired.
No, yeah, exactly. So, and the thing is, every time in between these, they cut to like 11 from Stranger Things. And like, they're doing like some, you know, uncovering the conspiracy going on. It's so fucking obnoxious. Like, it's intrusively bad. Previously in these movies, the human stuff was bad, but you're like, eh, whatever. Here, it's just fucking obnoxiously bad. So, but no. So Kong finds the axe, right? He puts it in this like slot there, and like it activates the thing, right? Sure. Godzilla senses this and gets mad, so he does an atomic breath beam, piercing through the earth all the way down to the middle of Hollow Earth, that charges the axe. Sure. So through this hole, Kong jumps back to the surface to fight Godzilla. Sure. They fight and like just Godzilla fucking wrecks Kong again. and then Mechagodzilla activates. But when it activates, like they get the power thing, right? Then they activate it at full power. But when they activate it at full power, it, like, they lose control over it, and like Ghidorah's spirit takes over. Sure. So Mechagodzilla and Godzilla start fighting, and Mechagodzilla's design is really cool. The fight scenes in this movie are pretty cool. And they're like very neon and whatever. Like they're not grounded at all. It's like very Pacific Rim. Mechagodzilla and Godzilla fight, and like Mechagodzilla overpowers Godzilla. But then Kong wakes up, and they convince him that you know, Godzilla isn't the enemy, Mechagodzilla is. So Kong starts, like, they start attacking Mechagodzilla together, and Godzilla charges the axe with his breath, and then Kong kills Mechagodzilla. That's the movie. And it's like just get, like, getting bra- I felt it's like getting brain damage. Like, it's just like it's just like way too much, and just like just complete nonsense, really stupid. The human stuff is aggressively bad. The fight scenes are really cool, but I, like, to give you like a barometer, the Michael Bay Transformer movies were better in terms of injecting human stuff and like not being like aggressively stupid.
Yikes.
Like, I love Godzilla. I'm a huge fan of Godzilla.
Yeah.
But like, it's like fucking everything else around the fights was just so aggressively bad. And like, it's just like, oh my god. Like, I would say watch it. It's fun in a really, really dumb way. But like, if you take out the human scenes from this movie, it makes it like infinitely better. And if it's just like, you know, 30, 40 minutes of just monsters fighting, that would be just like so much better movie. And like all this like dumb bullshit about fucking hollow earth and like piercing through the core of the earth is like magic. It's like none of this, like, the thing is, you can't invest in anything. Like in the previous movies, you had stuff to invest into, right? Like there was a sense of danger. These monsters are terrifying. Like, no. And the fucking thing is, the reason that the tech company, where they're bad, they built Mechagodzilla to like protect the earth from Godzilla, but they're bad. But like, Godzilla in this movie just like is bad. So like the tech company is right. So like, why are we supposed to see them as villains? Like, it's like nothing in this movie makes sense, to the point that it like detracts from the monster fights, because they're just like, oh my god, it's just like infuriating.
I'm going to be real with you. I'm not going to watch this. It sounds absolutely horrible. Instead, I'll watch Shin Godzilla.
Yes.
Like an actually good Godzilla movie. Yeah, it's a shame. I think Godzilla is fucking awesome, and King Kong is fucking awesome. And I don't understand why it's so hard to make a good movie about them. Like, everything that is so fucking awesome about them is already there for you to do. And there's a universe of, like, other monsters. Like, the monsterverse is big. There's all sorts of shit you can tie it into.
There's a blueprint. Like, this has been done for 65 plus fucking years.
Yeah, yeah. It's been perfected, right? Like, just, I feel like,
and even in the Western context, Godzilla movie, like, the fucking Michael Bay has done this. Like, the Transformer movies are stupid, but they're fine. Like, they're enjoyable.
The first one was actually good. I think the first one was good, and the rest suck. But I think the first one was good. But also, like, I feel like anybody making a Godzilla movie should be forced to watch Shin Godzilla. Yes. And I'm not expecting you to adapt it, because it's very Japanese, right? Like, the whole, oh, bureaucracy is important, but also it fails us. Yeah, that wouldn't track in, like, an American audience.
But you can make an American version of that.
Yeah, no, I totally agree that you could. But I think there's so much else to take from that. Like, why Godzilla is interesting, why Godzilla is scary.
So that's the thing. So there's two directions that you can take the monster movie, right? The kaiju movie. One of the directions is, it's allegory, right? Like the original Godzilla movie, which is allegory for the nuclear attacks. And Shin Godzilla, which is allegory for Fukushima, right? And how Japan handled Fukushima. So that's like, there's many examples of this being done. Or you go like the Pacific Rim route and embrace that it's like dumb bullshit, but like just make it work. And this movie goes the Pacific Rim route. But like the reason Pacific Rim worked was because, you know, even though it was completely larger than life and like over the top, you still invested in the characters and you still invested in the world, because like that stuff was done well. Like just because the human stuff is bad and nobody cares about it in the previous movies doesn't mean you need to make it like even worse. You can like either just completely cut that stuff out and just be like 90 minutes of just monsters fighting, and I'm sure that would work, or like make the human stuff not like aggressively bad. Invest in it a little bit, right? Like the
I have the solution.
Yeah.
Guillermo del Toro should make a Godzilla movie.
Yes. That's it.
Yeah.
Or like
just let him
I was talking to Cody about this. There's like a few directors that could handle it. I mean, Michael Bay could make a Godzilla movie.
Yeah. He could make a great Godzilla movie. Michael Bay is like a very specific tool that you have in your house.
Yeah.
It's like good for that one thing that he does.
And James Wan could make a Godzilla movie. Like Aquaman was great. Like it's pure dumb nonsense, but done in a really good way. And you know who could make a better Godzilla movie than this one?
Yeah.
Zack Snyder.
Yeah.
He would make a killer Godzilla movie.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's within his wheelhouse. Also, while we're drafting like future contracts for Godzilla movies, I think there should be a clause in them that requires Charlie Day to be cast.
Oh my god.
You gotta cast Charlie Day.
Even if it's Charlie Day in like a monster suit. Like he's like one of the kaijus.
No. I don't care. He can be like a go boy. Right? Like he needs to be on set because I feel like his energy will make your kaiju movie better. And if you can get Bernd Gorman, the other scientist, I also love that guy. And it's a shame that he's remembered as that guy because he also played in Torchwood and in The Expanse and a bunch of really other great stuff. If you can get him, that's cool. They make a really good duo. He was actually in Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Yep.
He was the scientist on the Flowers for Charlie episode. which is, that was before Pacific Rim. So I wonder if like Del Toro watched that episode of Sunny and was like, I should cast these guys together as scientists. Anyway, thanks for listening.
One more. Let's find one more person that would do a killer Godzilla movie. Even Nolan would do better.
Jim Jarmusch.
Jim Jarmusch. Who was he?
No, I'm joking. I'm joking. Ghost Dog, The Way of the Kaiju.
My God. Wes Anderson.
Wait, it's Jim, right?
It's Jim Jarmusch. Jarmusch. Right.
I watched Broken Flowers last week. I rewatched it. Ronnie watched it for the first time. It's Jim Jarmusch with Bill Murray. And it's a very interesting, it's not funny at all. It's a really depressing movie. And I think it's really interesting to watch today because it has a lot to say about toxic masculinity. Mm-hmm. And the internet, the early days of the internet figure the pretty importantly, 2005, I think it was made. Very good movie. Yeah, but Jim Jarmusch can't make a Godzilla movie. I was joking.
Wes Anderson would make a better Godzilla movie.
Oh my god. Wes Anderson's Godzilla. I would watch the shit out of that. So it's like Adrian Brody,
yeah.
Right? He was in a Godzilla movie, wasn't he?
Was he? Sure.
I don't know. He was in everything, in a lot of things.
Edward Norton.
And Rachel Weisz. Edward Norton, fucking all the other, like George Clooney or whatever, Godzilla movie.
Yeah.
I'd watch that.
He was in King Kong, not in Godzilla.
King Kong, right. I knew he was in like the monster.
The Peter Jackson King Kong.
Sorry?
The Peter Jackson King Kong, not the...
The one with Jack Black, right?
That was a good movie.
Yeah.
And it had a really good video game. It was one of the, like a really... Did you ever play that game? It's a really interesting, really good, like cult classic game. It's like a first person adventure shooter type of game. It was really good, actually.
Wait, is that the one where Kong fights a giant squid?
Yes.
Yeah, I saw that movie on the plane. That movie was really good.
Yep.
I also watched Shin Godzilla on the plane, by the way.
Okay.
And it was
it in theaters. It was really good.
Yeah.
So, okay. No, one last. Sorry. I'm just going to rate these movies, the kind of universal monsterverse.
Oh, yeah. Good idea. Yeah.
I think, so a lot of people think Kong Skull Island is the best. I just don't like Kong, so I'm going to rate it lower than I maybe should. So for my favorite is Gareth Edwards' Godzilla 2014. That movie is like actually fantastic. And then Kong Skull Island, and then King of the Monsters, and then... Zack Snyder's Justice League. And then Converse guys. Look.
Where would you put the first Pacific Rim?
First Pacific Rim, I'd put it above Godzilla. Like, it's the best one.
Yeah, I agree. Man, Pacific
Rim. The Pacific Rim anime is decent on Netflix recently. It's better than the second, worse than the first.
Okay, I'll check it out. I enjoyed the second for what it was. Mm-hmm. It wasn't as good as the first one, of course, but I think it was
pretty okay. I'm interested in your take on Zack Snyder's Justice League.
I'm not going to watch it.
It's not bad. It's fine.
It's 4 hours.
You can break it up. It literally has chapters. Like, you can stop at...
It's 4 hours.
Treat it like a TV show, man.
I don't care about any of those characters. I hate Ben Affleck.
I hate him, too. Have you seen Aquaman?
I'll do it for the meme.
Have you seen Aquaman?
No. Why would I see
Aquaman?
Because
it's really good. It's James Wan.
Jason Momoa has... I don't understand the obsession with this guy. He has zero charisma on screen. Zero. I don't get it.
It's a James Wan movie.
No, wait. I did see it. I saw it on the plane. Is that the one where... Oh, it's so weird. In the end, it's like a really big battle, right? Like, lots of fish and crabs and mecha crabs and all amazing. That shit. I watched it. It was good for what it was. It wasn't as bad as Wonder Woman.
Yes. Wonder Woman is bad. Anything James Wan does is good. Anyway.
Are you going to force me to watch the Snyder Cut? Is this what's happening? I'm going to go Joker mode.
Do it.
Full Joker mode.
They cut out the We Live in a Society scene from the...
I understood that it never existed in the first place and it was recorded for the trailer.
Yes, and then it's not in the movie.
Yeah. False. I'm going to go Joker mode over that. That's what's going to drive me over the edge. Okay.
Right.
Thanks for listening. Bye. Wrap around and gather.